IATSE 891 presents Apple Box Talks, the podcast where we get to talk to the very best artists, technicians, and interest holders that make up the BC entertainment industry. From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes.
Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Crystal. Today on the Apple Box, we're joined by academic and activist Dr. Stephanie Dick. Stephanie is an expert on AI and a historian of mathematics and technology with a PhD from Harvard University. With over 15 years of research experience, she examines what AI is, what it does, and how its use is changing our world, our work, and ourselves. She's also one of our keynote speakers and panelists at our upcoming AI Day of Learning and Engagement, happening on March 7th and 8th. Welcome to the Apple Box, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me, Crystal and Hillary. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being here. It's always a pleasure to welcome you back. Some of our listeners heard you speak from the recordings from last year's Day of Learning, and we're thrilled to have you back again. So thank you for giving us so much of your time.
My pleasure.
So artificial intelligence has been one of the hot topics for the last 5 years, people talking about new tools, new toys, new challenges, new fears. But with your academic background, I think you have a different kind of bird's eye view of where it actually fits within history. That this, while it's been talked about a lot, it's very loud right now. This is not a new conversation we're having, especially in the worlds of academia and labor. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Oh, it's such an important question because I think everyone is feeling that we're in a fairly unprecedented historical moment, and I don't deny that's true, but I think it's also very helpful to know that a lot of what we're going through is the long tail of a much longer history that I actually situate starting with the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. I think a lot of people are familiar with some parts of that story, that physical labor, craft labor, manufacturing labor went from being something that very small numbers of skilled people did to the work of steam-powered factories that required that work to be broken down into a series of more basic steps that could be done in a repetitive way by less well-trained or less skilled workers. And that rearranged so many forms of power and capital creation. But a part of the story that I think is a lot less well-known is that in the context of European industrialization, there were certain people who looked at the factory and said, I want to do for the mind what the factory has done for the body. I want to figure out whether thinking could be treated as a kind of work and subjected to industrial and managerial optimization. And they started with mathematical calculation, which used to be considered the domain of genius philosophers. And they asked, can we apply this principle of the division of labor to what mathematicians are doing? Can we break down this hard cognitive work of solving complex calculations into a series of additions and subtractions, for example, that people with less of a mathematics understanding and education would be able to carry out? And maybe they don't know, for example, what a logarithm is, but if you had hundreds of them working together doing additions and subtractions in the right way, they could maybe solve a logarithmic equation. And crucially, that work was called computing work. These human computers were the first computers. And the moment that mathematics became a kind of less skilled, lower paid form of work, it also became women's work. Most human computers throughout history were women who were carrying out these broken down mathematical operations. But that idea that thinking and knowing and intelligence aren't something that inhere in people, but that could be sort of extracted from people, broken down and made available for industrial optimization, that to me is one of the core ideas that has driven so much of the history of artificial intelligence. And we can really see it at work today, where the goal is to put as much of human output and and human intelligence and human creativity into these central repositories that can be subjected to optimization of certain forms and managerial control of certain forms that people cannot. And the whole intervening history gives us examples of different attempts to sort of get intelligence out of people and put it into machinery or to break it down into the type of work that can be optimized through a managerial perspective.
That's really fascinating and really speaks to some of the fears that our members bring us and some of the fears that we notice come up around AI in general related to labor. And really just sort of demystifying, you know, AI's been around for a very long time. It just hasn't been called AI. And so, you know, we've talked about this before. We take a very human-centric approach to it. Can you tell us, what does a human-centric approach look like to you? What does that mean?
I mean, what I'm the most afraid of myself in this moment, especially in my position as an educator, is that we all just start outsourcing our work, right? We just use ChatGPT to do all the things for us. And I've already seen some of the results of that in my classrooms, and it's students pulling away from their own questions, their own curiosity, their own instincts, and they're no longer engaging in the struggle that leads to deep learning. Not the deep learning in the neural network sense, but the deep learning that can come from engaging and struggling as people with questions that we care about. And so I think we are tasked currently across the board with figuring out how to keep people in the driver's seat. And I think that requires that we develop cultures where curiosity and criticality are valued more highly than they ever have been before, because otherwise everyone is going to start deferring to and outsourcing to the same tools, and we will witness some mass de-skilling events across the board and also lose our generative friction. Part of what I keep seeing is that the more we integrate technological tools into our lives, the more our attention and intuition and understanding shifts towards the tool. So even when I have students who, for example, don't just use ChatGPT to write their papers for them, but they go back and forth with it, they're editing its drafts, they're asking it questions, I'm not so sure that what they're learning is the history of technology that I'm trying to teach them. They're learning ChatGPT in some fundamental way. They're learning its limitations and possibilities, its idiosyncrasies and behaviors. And if everyone, especially in the creative industries, start turning their intuition and their attention and outsourcing towards the same tools, we're going to lose the profound differences that can only come from contingent human experience. And I am for sure worried about job loss. I am for sure worried about the displacement of a lot of laborers. But I think we're going to learn really quickly that the actual value of these tools is not what they replace and take away from us, but rather the way they can deepen our curiosity and our difference in generative ways. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I know that keeping people curious and critical and confident is both a solution to labor loss concerns, and it's also a solution to potential de-skilling. But it's a hard fight to keep people engaged and in the driver's seat with such a compelling driver trying to steer folks in these very specific directions that align with what generative AI can do. So I think there's a lot of room right now for everybody to be asking some really fundamental questions. And this is the thing that actually excites me the most about AI. It's not the tools themselves necessarily and what they can do or can't do or should do or shouldn't do for us. I'm excited that everyone has been pushed to ask really foundational questions right now in the university. It's not, what are we learning? What should we be learning? It's also, how do we learn? Why do we learn? And I think in many contexts, including the creative industries, is an invitation to get back to the foundational questions about what is meaningful for us to do? How do we keep ourselves curious? And I'm excited about what will come out of those conversations and the self-reflection that AI is pushing all of us to do.
There's so much to unpack out of your answer. I'm like, just throw away our questions because now I have 12 more based on just your answer alone. The first that I want to kind of zero in on is the thread that your students aren't talking to each other or you anymore. They're talking to ChatGPT, and how that isolation is a significant social issue. And while we talk about AI at work, the broader impact is something also that we need to be curious about. I think from a motion picture perspective, we understand what it means to work in community. We can't do all the things. We have 19 departments with 144 different classifications because there is so much to be done and we can't do it by ourselves. But a lot of this new technology seems to be about what can we do by ourselves if someone's opened this electronic door to all of the stolen information on the internet.
Oh, Hillary, what a brilliant question. Yeah, it's absolutely right. There's such a profound individualism that's built in, and that also belongs to a much longer history of computing that has, in many different iterations and many different moments, said, now you, the individual, you have access to all the information that you need, all the jobs that you need, all of the everything that you need, you as an individual. And ChatGPT adds to that, as an example, a kind of sycophancy, right? Where we've reached this political moment where I am unsure that we are capable of having the forms of dialogue that might lead to resolutions of our deep political divides right now. And you throw into that mix a tool that tells you every idea you have is brilliant, every question you're asking is the right question. There's a kind of built-in sort of reinforcement of the views you come in with that a lot of these tools exhibit in their default modes. And so not only are the tools further isolating people and pulling them into themselves and away from community, they're also getting a reinforcement there that doesn't map onto our political realities. And I think we have to keep actual human struggle and human friction in the center of what it means to be democratic, right? And a lot of AI is marketed as a democratizing tool, that here we're going to give more people access to more information. They're going to have better access to experts. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to be easier. More people can participate in artistic creation or in research or in all of these things. But what they mean by that is that more people have access to stolen data, to copyrighted works, to basically do pastiche with. But I'm not so convinced that that's going to be all that generative, because as you say, individuals working alone in silos with existing material is actually a very limited framework for what creativity is. And you know, I say all the time, our artificial intelligence tools don't have access to the world. They're not out here experiencing what it's like to be a person in the 21st century. All they have are the data that we give them. And it's turned out there's a lot in that data. Our LLMs and our machine learning tools have learned so much from the data we can provide them. But all that data is from the past. All they're doing is pastiche and pattern matching on past articulations of what we care about. So I'm not sure anything new will come out of it, anything really new. And I'm not sure anything democratic will come out of it that's really democratic. It's about individuals having a sandbox to play in that's really powerful. But I love this question so much because I do see my students having anxiety even about coming to class, right? Sort of basic exposure to other people can be really scary. And it was kind of a perfect storm into which to introduce a tool like ChatGPT in 2022 for political reasons, for pedagogical reasons, and for these social reasons that we got to keep talking to each other as the primary manifestation of our democracy and our creativity.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's why it's so easy? People anthropomorphize this technology so quickly without even realizing they're doing it. And when we talk about contract language and we talk about how it's impacting the workplace, it almost sounds like you're talking about a coworker or a colleague rather than a structural tool or a technology. And that line is being so blurred.
Absolutely. And we do it all the time. I'll share that one of the very first chatbots, as we might call it, ever generated was by Joseph Weizenbaum at MIT. And he thought, I think I could make a computer program that could simulate a Rogerian therapist. And I've never had Rogerian therapy myself, but as I understand it, there's a lot of taking what's been said and reframing it as a question to give back to the client or the patient. And so Weizenbaum said, okay, I'm going to make a chatbot that takes a statement and kind of returns it to the person who gave it, really basic computationally. So somebody could say, you know, I'm having trouble with my father. And it would respond, sounds like you're having trouble with your father, kind of. And he got his assistant or his secretary to talk to Eliza, you know, in the 50s. And it's sort of an apocryphal story in the history of computing, but she asks him to leave the room. She feels like a deep connection to this chatbot. And Weizenbaum, who was one of the founders of artificial intelligence at MIT, the experience led him to become one of the earliest critics because he said, like, surely it matters that there is a person on the other end of our therapeutic experience, and it matters because bearing shame to another person is a really different experience than doing so with a machine, he thought. He said, you know, there has to be understanding for healing work to happen. And so he made a very early case for keeping humans in the center of certain forms of judgment and certain forms of interaction. But starting from there through early emotive robotics that were made to look really cute like a baby and to recoil if they were yelled at and to sort of be like some hybrid of a kitten and a baby. Kismet is who I'm thinking of, one of the early affective robots at MIT. And people like loved this thing, right? And so we have a great capacity to cultivate relations, I think, with technologies and non-human things, which is so profound and powerful about us in a way. But I also fear, like Weizenbaum, that the more we swap in non-humans for some of these really essential political, pedagogical, psychological, creative interactions, we're losing everything that holds us together. Where is our shared meaning supposed to come from? Where is our shared struggle supposed to come from if we're all just alone at home, you know, chatting with our chatbots?
There are so many different roads we can go down. I really love just taking it back to kind of the one of the most grounding things you said at the beginning of this conversation about how this is actually forcing us to look at who we are and how we function in the world, and just the power of a person witnessing you in your struggle, in your successes, and now how that's being transferred in other ways that are non-human. And I just want to connect that as well to, you said one of my favorite words, intuition. I mean, art and creation is so tied to the human magic of intuition. And at one of the last AI panels I saw you on, the ScreenBC panel, you talked about the intentionality of reference. And that is such a powerful phrase, particularly for artists. And I'd love you to walk us through that.
Oh, thank you so much for the question, Crystal. I've been thinking about this so much myself lately. And I'm not a particularly creative person myself, but I nonetheless am able to recognize sometimes when, oh, this director is referencing this other director, or this comic book artist is referencing this other comic book artist. And to see people, craftspeople, working with other people's ideas and engaging them and putting them together in new ways, and trying to think about, I wonder why they made that reference or that one. And in my academic work, it's the same. I'm very intentional about whose work I want to cite when I publish material, because it signals who I'm in conversation with, who I'm learning from, who I'm building on. And I don't think you can read anybody's academic work without looking at their footnotes, because that tells you everything about where this text is situated in the shared landscape of struggle with ideas. And in a very technical sense, generative AI is making all kinds of references all the time as well, because it is trained essentially to do pastiche with existing text, existing image, existing art. It's recombining it and putting it together according to its statistical models in order to output a convincing sentence or image. Except that we don't get to know inside the messy neural networks that these models are constituted by. We don't get to know what's being referenced, what's being picked out, what's being recombined in what the LLM is doing. And to my mind, that robs us of an entire layer of meaning and connection and intentionality in our work. And, you know, you can ask ChatGPT sort of, what are you drawing on when you output this text to me? And it can give you an answer, but sometimes the references are fabricated and we don't actually know if what it's reporting is what's really going on under the hood. Even some of the people who work on developing these models, you know, there are mathematical limits to how well we can understand what they're doing, what they're drawing from. And so I feel like it will be such a tragedy if we can no longer trace these intentional maps of connection and reference and the meaning that they bring, because it's part of collective meaning making to reference one another with intention, you know? And it's even in the superficial cases or more superficial cases where we stop reading each other's work and we all just start reading AI-generated summaries of each other's work, we will still impoverish the way that we reference one another and engage with one another. Like, sometimes people pull something out of somebody's book that I don't even know if that author meant for that to be there. But it, when we read each other closely or engage each other thoughtfully in artistic and academic work, that's a whole level of meaning beyond content. And something I keep saying to my students these days is that, you know, we used to write things down because they were important. The written word was, especially, you know, throughout most of history where literacy was such a privilege and not equally distributed across the population, you know, people thought, like, what are we going to use scribes' time for? And it's a lot of religion, it's a lot of receipts, it's economic records, it's religious writing. And those were signals of what was most important, most meaningful, most essential for society at that time. And now, with the internet flooded with AI-generated writing and image, I'm not so sure the written word is a signal anymore of what is meaningful to us. So in addition to losing that referencing, we're also losing the signaling of what's most meaningful. And I think we're going to have to look to new places and ways of referencing with intention and of sort of signaling what is most meaningful that might look totally different than what we've been doing. And I don't think there's anyone better positioned than people in the creative arts to reflect on that question, but we want more meaning, not less. At least I do.
I think you've hit on it, because I think whenever I see AI show up on my computer or my Google search or whatever, it's always an AI summary. It's not an AI expansion. Like, we as collaborative folks tend to get taught really early, like if you do improv or you do like conversations and like with little kids at school, instead of saying no, you say yes and. And AI doesn't yes and. There's that gap of, we want to be collaborative, we want to be additive. And when we talk with motion picture artists and technicians, a lot of them have said, you know, we went from, I mean, not the ones we're talking to right now, didn't go from silent to sound, but from black and white to color, from all of those changes, but they felt additive and expansive to the world of storytelling, to capturing those moments in humanity that we wanted to commit to film, to tell that story, to commit to history. This feels reductive.
It's such a, oh yeah, such a, I feel like I'm starting every answer with, that's a great question, but they are also great. I love this conversation. Yeah, absolutely. And I am very open and excited about the possibilities of using these technologies in ways that do in fact deepen and add. but that's not been the overall driver for their use cases and their implementation, which are so much more focused on efficiency than they are on insight. And there are ways to use these tools that are pushing us and everyone towards the superficial, towards the 5-bullet-point high-level summary. There's a lot of industrial context in which that's been the unit of exchange for a long time. ChatGPT is really good at the 5-point summary of whatever it is. And that does feel really reductive to me, or that it's moving everyone towards a more superficial level of engagement with ideas, with each other, with problems. I really want to believe also that if we use them without the sort of efficiency paradigm hanging over us, but really ask, like, what could I learn from integrating engagement with this kind of tool in collaboration with people, in alignment with what is meaningful to us, that there might be opportunities for deeper insight and not just more efficiency. But so far, it really seems like the value add that's being offered in so many contexts is just that we can do this faster and often more superficially. And to come back to a point that Crystal raised earlier about sort of how everybody's having to ask really foundational questions right now, I would absolutely put the university in that position, because students are using AI for everything. And we've moved from, you know, oh, maybe we can just design our assignments the right way so that you can't use AI to do them, to I'm not sure we can do that exactly. And so I have some colleagues who really want to, you know, die on the hill of the research paper, right? That if students aren't learning how to do research and write research papers without the assistance of an AI tool, we're failing in our humanities education. I have other colleagues who think, you know, why are we writing anymore? because writing is no longer the thing that we need to do. We need to be doing something else. And I don't have a position on the research paper. I'm not going to die on that hill myself. But the thing I care about is that students are learning deeply and for real, and not defaulting to this sort of superficial level of engagement. But the tricky part of that problem of keeping us engaged, keeping our understanding deep and our creativity meaningful, is that it sort of has to come from us. You know, like, the thing a student needs to learn deeply in the age of AI is their own curiosity. They have to bring that to the room. Otherwise, it's so easy to default to the outsourcing move. And I think that it's through things like collective organizing that we will be able to inspire people and cultivate in people that drive to struggle, that drive to learn and understand deeply. Because I think, you know, students navigating the world alone, artists navigating the world alone, it's a lot harder to call on whatever that intuition is, that curiosity is. You know, I keep telling students, like, this is the era of good questions. You have to have good, deep questions, and then maybe this tool can give you deeper insights. But this framing of the history of the creative arts as being engaged with technologies that add to the craft rather than take away from the craft, I still hope there's a way that that can happen. And if anyone will figure it out, it'll be the folks in your organizations. But it only will happen if we push against the efficiency gains and identify other values to drive our engagement.
That's such a good point. So, you know, maybe sometimes it's going back to basics. Maybe it's not going to be a new tool. Maybe it's the tools that we already have, right? And just circling back and figuring out how to actually integrate it more instead of just whole scale abandoning it.
I sure hope so. And I think this is already happening. I saw an article in the New York Times, I don't know how long ago, about how the youth, I no longer know who qualifies as the youth, but are more engaged in analog hobbies than for the last several generations. They want to get together, they want to make crafts, they want to go biking, they're running, they're doing all kinds of things that were less fashionable for people of my generation or other digital natives, as it were. And I also have heard so many people, as Hillary already said earlier, talking about just being totally oversaturated with AI-generated content, your eyes sort of glaze over. There's a brilliant artist at NYU, Tiga Brain, who was working on trying to create a version of the internet that was pre-2022 so that, you know, it wouldn't be up to date, but you could search this internet before it was flooded with a bunch of AI-generated content. And there's so much interest in this kind of thing that I think is absolutely a backlash to the sort of screen-based individualism of the modern 21st century knowledge economy, as we call it. And I was also reading about a thing, I think it was in LA, called Lectures on Tap, where apparently people are like paying money to go to bars and hear academics talk about stuff. And like that is not a thing that would have happened in the earlier 21st century. But as so much more of our content and our work is becoming about just our inboxes and our screens, and now it's all flooded. You don't even know if you're engaging with a person or not. And I had a friend who was applying for a job at OpenAI at some point, and he said, for sure, ChatGPT wrote the job ad. ChatGPT also probably wrote most of the applications, and ChatGPT also probably was the first one to rank them. It's like no person is going to feel a sense of meaning in their life if our work is just shuffling around AI-generated content as the new efficient form of the knowledge economy. I don't believe it. And so I think the more life and work and school start to feel like that, the more people are going to go looking for real, novel, creative people and works and human interaction. I can only believe that that's what will come of it. But in the meantime, I do think we are going to be losing jobs. There's massive theft of artists' data. There are a lot of reasons to be angry in this moment. I am, you know, I got an email from a press that I'd published with recently saying, you know, we're being given the opportunity to opt in to AI training, even though we already know our texts have been used in AI training. But if you opt in, then you get a little bit of royalties, maybe like 2 cents a year or something to the press. And, you know, my co-editor and I were like, well, I guess we're opting in, but it's like none of this feels good. And, you know, there's more of us than them, right? And I think that overwhelmingly people are going to have to look for meaning somewhere outside of that landscape of AI-generated content. And I'm excited about what we will find.
You also said something else at the panel that you were at that really struck me, and I think struck a lot of people in the room. You said something about who decides what information is going into these LLMs, these large language models, and who is making those decisions and why?
Oh, it's such a great question. I know we think about data as if it was sort of out there, like facts, right? These are the facts that we just gather them all up. But we've got a saying in communication studies and history of science that there's no such thing as raw data, not anywhere, not ever. All the data we've ever created, all of the records we've ever stored, every archive that's ever been created has all reflected the values and priorities of the people doing the counting or the storing or the saving. You can take something as simple as the census to make this point where, you know, a state is meant to determine what they need to know to govern the population, and they have to decide, what do I need to know to govern the state? And, you know, for a long time, white men between the ages of, I think, 16 and 35 were counted really differently from everyone else because they were seen to constitute both the military and the economic potential of the state. So we have a lot more data about that demographic through history than everyone else. So even this attempt to just count the population reflected racial and gender-based hierarchies and the social order of the time. And the truth is, of course, that most of the time, the people making decisions about what to count and who to count and how to count are people who have considerable power and who are also often invested in the maintenance of the status quo. And so there are so many people's values and histories and stories that haven't been captured in the data that, you know, goes into some of these systems. LLMs were a little different because they've been sort of let loose on the whole of the internet and this whole corpus of largely stolen material that does represent better the world than a curated data set that might train an earlier instance of an artificial intelligence. And yet there's no universe in which I could be convinced that the internet is an accurate representation of humanity, right? Like, so asking who, you know, whose stories, whose accounts, whose philosophies are not present on the internet is a deep question. And this comes out especially in conversations about Indigenous knowledge. Who doesn't want their information or their outputs or their culture to go into the mix to train these tools? There's a way of being excluded that's a problem. If you're not represented in the data set, then the LLM knows nothing about you and can't represent your views. But if you are included in it, then the LLM has access to your information and can speak on your behalf about your views. And for many communities and cultures, both are deeply problematic. We call one, you know, there's forms of predatory exclusion, and there are also forms of predatory or extractive inclusion. And that's why any conversation for me about AI regulation or the sort of future of governance around these issues, we need better models for how people control and engage with their own information in the world. And it can't be the case that there's four companies that get everybody's stuff and that's what we all use at work, right? So it's such an important question, Crystal. Thank you.
There was a debate a couple of months back at my old university that I went to in Auckland in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, for the Indigenous Māori language was classified as a dying language. And so policy was changed and a shift to protected language, to cultivate speakers. Similar things happening around the world with Indigenous populations and how colonialism has impacted Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous culture. And the debate that they had was fascinating because it looked at what you've just said about how when there is inclusion, it can become almost a colonial, well, this is now our monolith. We have all the information we need. You actually don't need to be here anymore. But then on the other side, they had a visiting professor from Mongolia who comes from an even significantly smaller group, like in the hundreds of people left from their Indigenous group in Mongolia, where they said AI is their only hope that they feel that they have to protect what they have and to generate more content based on the scraps that have been preserved when they've been significantly persecuted and colonized. And this tension in underrepresented communities that I think brings us back to your original thing of we have to ask more and better questions of one another.
Oh, it's so important. I don't claim to have any frameworks on offer for what this kind of thing can look like, but I've been so inspired by so many of the Indigenous AI projects for showing us a different way of thinking about data, about collective and collaborative work. I had the real honor of doing just a very bit of supportive work for Caroline and Michael Running Wolf, who are trying to build AI tools to help preserve and teach dying Indigenous languages. And from start to finish, you know, when they think about the voice donors who are going to be speaking, these elders who still carry the languages, from the very beginning, these people have to be paid appropriately. They have to be supported appropriately. We have to build technology that works for them throughout the process as well. They're thinking about how can we train Indigenous people in these technical skill sets as we go about developing these tools so that we're building skills at the same time. How are we thinking about where this data is being stored and how it's being used and who can have access to it? And just the thoughtfulness, the collaborativeness, and the community orientedness of every part of the project was so inspiring, because so often in more Western dominated companies and organizations, something called ethics might come after the fact, right? Or they're sort of, whoops, we built a thing and it did something bad and now we have to fix it. And I wish that we were so much more intentional about what we're building, how we're building it, who we're building it with. And as somebody who studies the history of technology, I have these colleagues, Andy Russell and Lee Vintzel, who became really big advocates for the study of maintenance. They're like, capitalism loves innovation, but it's less good at valuing and incentivizing the maintenance work that actually keeps society running. And as kind of a piece of that emphasis on maintenance, it's like, this move fast and break things, this like see what we can do and then solve the problems after. I mean, it's having catastrophic effects on our society, our democracy, our planet. And we're always like, please don't move fast and break things. Like, can we do something with intention here? And it also highlights for me a point about the history of computing in general, where so often computer scientists figure out first what they can do, and then they try to figure out how that's a solution to the problem. They less often start with the problems that communities articulate or that are so visible all around us and think, okay, how thoughtfully and intentionally can we engage this community and solve this problem? It's like, let's see what we can get the computer to do. And then, oh, by the way, this is what everyone needs at work now. And I just wish, you know, sometimes there are good reasons and moments for technology to lead and for us to explore and experiment. But, you know, those systems shouldn't end up in our courtrooms and our classrooms immediately. And they don't always do the community engagement that so many tech companies claim to care about, because it looks really different in practice, you know.
History is repeating itself right now. So the federal government came out with an AI survey. The provincial government came out with an AI survey. They were very top-down, business-driven questions. I mean, nothing that was about society, community, the average British Columbian or the average Canadian and AI's impacts on them. And I remember you saying, again, at the last panel, it was a good one, people just plow ahead and move forward and then figure out the environment and the ethics after, but they never really do. And so from your perspective, I'm curious, what do you think legislation could look like?
Oh, it's such an important question, and it's such a difficult one, because I attend sometimes these conversations about AI policy, and I'm not even sure what we're talking about, because AI is such a moving target, and the different registers at which you could have that conversation are really difficult. But yeah, like, we still haven't solved all of the problems of the internet, right? And we were promised that they would all be sorted out at some future time. And that's a lot of how the history of tech works. We're always being promised the tools will be fixed in the future, the biases will be corrected for in the future, everything's going to be okay around the next, you know, after the next update or the next turn. This has been one of the main themes of my colleague Wendy Chun's work, who wrote a wonderful book called Updating to Stay the Same, where, you know, the promise of the future perfection of technology does so much to validate and justify the harms it causes now in the moment. And I think for the regulation piece, I just keep coming back again and again and again to the environmental piece. It's actually the only way I could imagine doing something like, quote unquote, regulating AI. And I'm sure, as folks are now well aware, there are huge environmental costs to the development and the use of generative AI and large language models. And that comes in the form of energy consumption and water consumption. But a piece of it that's maybe a bit less well known is that so much of our geopolitical landscape today and so many areas of conflict in the world right now are also, at least in part, about the rare earth materials that are required to manufacture the microchips and the GPUs that power these systems. And these are places like Ukraine, Canada, the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're looking at oil in Venezuela. A lot of geopolitical conflict right now is about control over rare earths. And if you were to, I don't know what body could do something like this, but if you were to regulate power and water consumption and resource extraction, you would at the same time be regulating AI. You would be pumping the brakes at a planetary scale. And somehow that's just not really on the table, but I'm worried the planet can't take it, right? And that we're going to quickly discover that the tools have outpaced our capacity to maintain ecosystems as well as social systems, and that we're going to have to deal with the consequences of that at some point. I think any person who's ever had a, I don't know, like hit the wall in their life, you know, we can't run away forever hoping we can solve the problems in the future. And, you know, the consequences always get you. So I think we'll see some of that as well.
Well, on that horrifying note,
I was trying to be positive, but I'm actually such a downer.
Well, that's the conundrum we find ourselves in, especially in the creative industries, right? Like, we don't want to get left behind. We must remain competitive, especially in the global landscape of motion picture and television.
Of course.
And we're really good at adapting to technology and making it better. But this is happening so quickly, and the environmental impacts and the ethics that we're all talking about here, it's like having one foot in that world and one foot in the world that keeps moving forward. And it feels sometimes like they're just getting farther and farther and farther apart.
Absolutely. I feel it too. I wear a lot of different hats, and very few of them allow me to say, like, let's not use it, mm-hmm. right? Because it doesn't land anymore, these kinds of positions. We hear everywhere, the race is on, the cat's out of the bag, there's no going back. And one thing, and maybe this is a good note for me to end on, I think, is that the whole history of AI actually is a history of fear. AI itself is a term that gets coined in the 1950s in the middle of the Cold War, and they are genuinely afraid that human beings might not be up for the task of maintaining safety and peace in a nuclear world, that we're too slow at processing information, we're too emotional, we're too arrogant, we're too superstitious, we're too this, we're too that. And that's why so much faith gets put in the computer at that moment, as maybe this machine can guarantee our safety, maybe it can make us feel in control of this really chaotic, terrifying nuclear Cold War world. And that is where AI is born. It's born in this crucible of fear and doubt in people. And that's powered so much of its history. And if there's one antidote, I think, it's what if we came from a place that wasn't fear, and what if we came from a place that wasn't so doubting of our own extraordinary capacities? I want to know what our technology looks like and how we'll use it if we're not just trying to be in control of a messy world and solve the problem of the human, but if we really invested in what we can do. And that's at the heart of community and labor organizing and collective action. That's what it has always been about, is putting our capacity to do something in the face of every other form of power, and we need it more than ever.
You brought us background.
You sure did. Thank you. I always feel like 100 years smarter after listening to you speak on this.
100%.
Well, it's such a gift to be able to talk with the both of you. And I'm so grateful to see how these things are playing out in real time in labor organizing context, because the rest of the world has a lot to learn from that. And I have a lot to learn from that.
So we're really excited. This is going to come out a couple of weeks before our AI engagement and learning event, March 7th and 8th. And you're going to be joining us again to speak in person on a couple of different topics. And it will give people a great opportunity to come up with some good questions to bring to you.
I can't wait.
Thank you, Dr. Stephanie. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Apple Box Talks is an IATSE 891 production and is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples. The podcast is hosted by Business Representative Crystal Bronworth and Assistant Business Representative Hilary Bergshaw, and produced by Quentin Benetti. For more episodes, check out ourwork.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Apple Box.